This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, an associate professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. So when we think about China's future prospects for economic growth, we often focus a lot on hot areas and industries like the low-end export-oriented manufacturing sector that drove growth for most of the past few decades, or the AI-fueled tech boom of recent years. But for any country, one of the most important determinants of the long-run economic growth is human capital, the education and health of its workers. Our guest today, Yanzhong Huang, has written an important book on China's environmental health crisis, examining not only its effects on people, but also the political and institutional barriers that have made it a hard problem to solve. The book also provides a great window into the way the Chinese system works in general, as the problems it outlines recur across a variety of economic and other policy areas. Yanzhong is a professor at Seton Hall University and director of its Center for Global Health Studies, and a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Among his many other accomplishments and credentials, he received his PhD in political science from the University of Chicago and is a member of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations Public Intellectuals Program. And his book is called Toxic Politics, China's Environmental Health Crisis and Its Challenge to the Chinese State. So, Yanzhong, thanks so much for joining us. Now, when people think about political science, public health is usually not one of the first topics that springs to mind. So how did you get interested in this broad area? I know you've been working on it for many years, even before this book.
Interesting question. Actually, this morning when I was giving a presentation at the Johns Hopkins University size event, you know, I was talking about the impact of the COVID, on U.S.-China relations, And it was also time to celebrate the release of that book, Engaging China, this, the 40 or 50 years of history, recognizing the achievement of Professor Mike Lampton, who's a longtime faculty member of the Johns Hopkins University. In fact, I was found it is interesting because Mike's research, his dissertation was about the politics of medicine in China in the Mao era. And so what I did when I was a PhD student at Chicago, I was entertaining all these ideas and what I should write on for my dissertation. And then my mentor, Dali Yang, just told me, why write something on health? I thought, initially, it was sort of a crazy idea, to be honest, because who would expect a political scientist to write on public health? But after I read Mike's book, I realized there's a lot a political scientist could actually write on in terms of the health politics in the post-Mao era. So my work was basically built upon Mike's work, even though the focus is on the post-Mao health politics. So that's sort of like nurtured my interest in study, you know, health issues from a governance, foreign policy, national security perspective. You know, so, you know, now I have this bifurcated interest, right? On the one hand, I'm interested in global health issues, you know, but in the meantime, I also have a regional interest in China.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I mean, certainly, obviously, these days, I think politics and public health have been much more intertwined in a lot of people's minds since the pandemic. But it's great that you were able to connect to this area early. And of course, as we all do as academics or in any other kind of intellectual endeavor, you're always standing on the shoulders of giants and trying to make your own individual incremental contribution to bring things up to date and keep track of how things are developing. All right. So your book is about the environment and public health. And so in the U.S., when we think about China and the environment, we usually think about climate change, since that affects us directly. You know, it's in the news here all the time. Why don't you first tell us more about what are China's other environmental problems that you focus on in the book, and how are they affecting the Chinese people?
Well, you know, actually, you know, speaking of climate change, right, certainly what sometimes we confuse is too, right, that this the contributor, right, to the greenhouse gases, you know, most of them, you know, actually not considered, right, the pollutants, you know, that causes air pollution, right, the issues like PM2.5, you know, the ozone, you know, this is actually not a major contributors, you know, to greenhouse gas effects, right? So, you know, here, but the book is, you know, focusing more pollution, right? Air pollution, water pollution, and soil pollution in China, even though it also tries to shed light, you know, this policy process in terms of China, how to deal with this climate change, you know, because, you know, these two, even though there are differences, you know, they're still interrelated in terms of, you know, that, you know, if you consider the corporate of the air pollution, right, the, like this fossil combustion, right, they're themselves also an important contributor to the climate change. So, you know, I want to focus on the three major links, you know, air pollution, water pollution, and soil pollution. And I found, you know, indeed, right, this pollution, right, this has been a major environmental health hazard in China. If you look at, you know, the outdoor air pollution, right, it is considered the largest single environmental health risk, because it's linked to 1.24 million premature death in China. You know, that accounts for nearly 40% of the global total, right? And of all the risk factors for pollution associated, you know, mortality, you know, this ambient, you know, PM2.5 is actually the number one killer, right? It is responsible for more than 1.1 million death. You know, that is one quarter of the total global attributable death, and 21.8% of the attributable global disease burden, right? This is in China. So, you know, this pollution has indeed been a major challenge to China's environmental health. You know, there's other challenges, you know, that associated with like food safety, right? Because pollution right now is increasingly also a food safety issue, right? China has a saying, you know, that for the emperor, the people are everything, right? For the people, food is everything. But if you look at, right, how, you know, that the food safety, right, the issue in the country, there was a study in 2002, you know, they found that in one of the few nationwide food safety tests, the Ministry of Agriculture might found that nearly 29% of the rice samples, you know, were laced with levels of lead, you know, that exceeded national safety standards, and 10% of them, had excess, you know, cadmium. You know, so all this, you know, that there has also important, profound implications for China's future.
Yeah. So the food safety issue. So it's not just, you know, I think I've thought more commonly of food safety as being about, you know, introduction of pathogens or obviously the prominent case where there were plastics introduced into milk, which were harmful to children into I think powdered milk. But you're saying there's also, you know, even if everyone is kind of perfectly honest along the way, once you grow the plant or something, but if the soil or water in which the plant is grown or in which the animal feeds is polluted, then you're still, you know, it's tainted from the start, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so this is how, you know, that when we talk about food safety, it's not just about adulterated food, you know, the melamines, you know, the chemicals, you know, being like mixed in the food, but also the pollution, right? The contamination, contaminated soil and water itself contribute to the problem.
Right. And once it enters the food network, that's also, you know, I was thinking, you know, one of the reasons why I think air pollution became a particular big issue is because it's just so hard to avoid, right? You know, rich or poor, you have to deal with polluted air. You know, dirty water, then the rich people can filter it, you know, buy bottled water or whatever. And, you know, food, you know, you can cook it and stuff, but yeah, if there's poison in just everything around you all the time, there's no way to avoid it, and it's hard to feel safe, no matter how privileged you are in other respects.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's huge health impacts from this. Other than, you know, straightforward public health impacts, are there other effects from this pollution problem on China or its relations with other countries?
Well, I think, you know, then we just talk about the health implications, right, of the those environmental challenges. But, you know, in the book, I also addressed the economic, right, social, political, and foreign policy implications, you know, China's environmental health issues. You know. You are the economist, right? You know better than I, this, the economic cost of pollution, right? Because if you use the, I think Tom Schelling developed this, it's a good value of a statistical life or VSL to measure, right, how much people are willing to pay to reduce the mortality risk, right? If we use that to measure the China's economic cost of pollution, right, the annual, the growth of total welfare losses, you know, due to premature mortality caused by this exposure to air pollution, you know, during 1990 and 2013 was estimated to be 11%. And, you know, the World Bank estimated that China lost 10% of the GDP to air pollution alone in 2013. You know, but if we include the cost of the non-fatal illness, you know, the total cost could be up to, according to my calculation, you know, 18% of the China's GDP, right? And it would be even higher if we consider the losses associated with water and soil pollution, right? You know, that Beijing, you know, that the U.S. AmCham, you know, they conducted this annual study, you know, on the executives, you know, U.S., you know, the executives, right, the of companies, you know, in Beijing, you know, they're, you know, asking them, you know, what is the top challenge, you know, for them, you know, trying to recruit and retain talents to work in China. You know, they actually for consecutive 3 years, right, that they name the air pollution as the top challenge, right? They also, right, the social, political consequences, right, this, even the Chinese government, you know, also admitted, right, that that is, you know, not just a complicated scientific problem. It is a sensitive social problem. You know, it matters to societal harmony and stability. You know, the government, you know, the legitimacy, you know, even national survival or prosperity. You know, so that's. You know, there's the, if you look at the number of this environmental related petition letters and complaints, right, between 1995 and 2015, right, it increased significantly from, you know, basically, right, less than like 100,000 in 1995, you know, to close to 1.8 million, right, in the country, right? So, and in the meantime, you know, this environmental health crisis has an international dimension. It's not just because it has an international origin, right, but also because, you know, China's, right, this environmental health problem, you know, can have spillover effects. You know, there was, you know, this study in 2014 by using the 2006 data, you know, for air pollution in China, you know, they found that when, you know, strong winds blew across the Pacific Ocean, you know, those pollutants, you know, produced by China's export sector accounted for at least, you know, at worst, right, 4% to 6% of the carbon monoxide, you know, recorded in the Western United States. Assume that's California, that's where you stay now. You know, up to 11% of the black carbon pollution and 12% to 24% of the sulfate concentrations. You know, so, you know, this is the impact also on international relations and global governance. You know, and you know, interestingly, the China's efforts to like close factories, you know, mines, you know, to reduce the pollution actually only drove up the prices of coal, steel, and aluminum. In 2017, you know, that in the international market. And so that is a very complicated global governance challenge.
Well, actually, let me back up just a sec. So you mentioned petitions, and since this is the economics channel, so not everyone here is going to know about this very unique sort of Chinese system. So what is the petition system, and why is that significant? Like, you know, in China, there's, you know, a billion plus people. So a million sounds like a lot, but I mean, it's a million what? And what is this system? How does it work?
Well, you know, those petition letters and complaints officially recorded, right, in the China's, you know, the system reporting, right, the Ministry of Environment, you know, the you know, until like 2015, you know, they had this system, you know, basically, you know, conducted the basic tally, you know, on those the number of people who wrote petition letters and complaints, you know, to the government. Because, you know, in China, certainly, right, we know, right, that when the people were responding to the issue of pollution, right, environment, and other environmental issues, you know, many people, or more, I would say most people, would choose, you know, just to, you know, like, complain, you know, informally, right? You know, this is sort of like what Albert Hirschman called the, you know, this the loyal, right? They would, you know, not, you know, officially, right, the complain to the government. You know, so that itself, you know, takes, you know, the courage to do so, and it should be seen as an indication of how strongly they feel about the pollution, the challenge of the environmental challenge in China.
Right. So this might be a letter written by someone who says, "Hey, there's a, you know, the river next to my house is black and mucky and smells like petroleum," or something like that. Or they might get a group petition together and have 20 or 50 or 100 people sign it and say, you know, "We're all really worried about this new factory that's going in," things like that.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, there could be like, you know, it's the initial, but until like 2010, you know, most of that is like there's complaints in the form of petition letters, right? But then, you know, after 2011, with the you know, the spread of the internet, like we have seen more of those complaints take the form of those electronic, right, like online complaints or just a, you know, cell phone call.
Okay. Well, so, all right, so the people are upset, the health impacts are severe, the Chinese government is worried about the long run economic impacts of this as well. But, you know, when we hear about China, we usually hear about it being a dictatorship and about the government forcing people to do what it wants, even in violation of, you know, Western ideas of human rights. They can impose a one-child policy, they can shoot protesters in the street, put minorities in camps, imprison Nobel Prize winners, or, you know, smack down their most high-profile internet entrepreneur when he's disrespected them. Or to put a more positive spin on it, you know, they were able to impose a lockdown and bring the coronavirus under control much more rapidly and effectively than in the U.S. So it seems like they have the power to do whatever they want to. So why are they having trouble stopping pollution?
Well, I think you're right. You know that we often talk about this top-down approach, right? The Chinese government and the Chinese people are very proud. You know that one of the advantages of the system is this ability to concentrate forces, right, to do so-called big things. You know, but for a long time, this issue of pollution, other environmental challenges, right, they have been there, but it has not been really, right, elevated, you know, as agenda item until after the end of 1990s, right? And China has not really launched an all-out war on pollution, right, until after 2013. You know, so first of all, right, you have this 4 decades of rapid industrialization, modernization, you know, that, basically contributed, you know, to all this, you know, these problems, right? You know, this, you look at the scale and scope, right, of this pollution in China, right? During 2011, 2013, right, China consumed more cement than the United States did in the entire 20th century, right? It consumes 21% of the energy in the world, right? So, you know, to tackle the problem pollution in China, we have to keep in mind, you know, this huge, tremendous challenge, right, that the government has to deal with, right? Not to mention there, but there's institutional reasons, you know, that were very resistant, right, in terms of these efforts, you know, to clean, right, the environment. Because we know, right, that, you know, after 1989 in particular, right, that the CCP, right, that needs to continuously justify its rule, you know, by not just sustaining rapid growth, but also consistently accomplishing concrete policy goals. You know, so that reliance on the performance-based political legitimacy encouraged this single-minded pursuit of economic growth to the detriment of the environment, you know, and the health of the people, right? So at the local level, you know, this ability to generate economic growth or fiscal revenues was the most important determining factor, right, in local officials' upward career mobility, right? So, you know, you have, you know, on the one hand, the tremendous challenges, right, that the government has to learn to deal with. But in the meantime, you have all this resistance, the institutional resistance, right, on preventing, right, the pollution control to being elevated onto the government agenda, right? So I think, you know, they, when we talk about, you know, like the lack of progress in fixing the environment, you know, we have to take into account that context.
So I think what I hear you saying is a little bit, I was reminded of, you know, in the early 90s, I think Larry Summers, when he was the chief economist for the World Bank, got himself in a lot of trouble by either writing or at least signing his name to a memo that pointed out by at least a very narrow economic logic that a lot of poor countries should be perfectly happy to pollute because, you know, yeah, you know, asthma is not good and maybe you lose a couple years of life, but if you, you know, get the resources to build schools and roads and put a roof over your head and, get yourself a car or television for the first time, you know, maybe that's a trade-off that people are willing to make and that's in some sense in their interest. I think he lost his job for that one, but in a sense, what I hear from you is there's a little bit that, you know, they didn't solve the problem. It sounds like both at the top levels of the Chinese government, they said, you know, economic growth is what we need. And even at the levels of That was the command coming down, but also that was the pressure coming up. Ordinary people weren't saying, no, please don't put a factory here. They were saying, we want the factory, and, they weren't that concerned about pollution.
Yeah, I think Larry Summers, was certainly said something, right? This many of the developing countries, like China initially, right, were thinking about, right, when, the Western countries were calling for, China and, other developing countries, to also, care about the environment, while, pursuing economic growth. But, at a time, when, the country was this, the sole concern was by economic development, it was to fulfill, right, this needs and demands for basic necessities, right, it is, understandable, right, those environmental issues will become, like a back burner issue, right? But people's expectations change, right, as China grows, become more prosperous, the people also, they have their expectations, change. Well, they were no longer, value, those basic necessities, right? They have started to value increasingly the importance of health, other, like needs like leisure, right? This is also measured by this VSL, right? This value of statistical life approach, right? They find that initially, right, people are willing to pay like 1 million yuan, reduce the mortality risk, right? But now, right, I'm just cut this. Peter. I think I made a mistake in a way by citing the data. I think if we look at the studies, the surveys conducted by Chinese economists, right, in Shanghai and Chongqing in 2005 and 2006, they found that the value of statistical life, that is an estimate of how much people are willing to pay to reduce mortality risk, right? It was, approximately 1 million yuan, that is about $122,000, that was actually much greater, than what is, implied, by, this other approach, right, that suggests, that, to measure, how much people are willing, right, to, mm-hmm. Pay to reduce the mortality risk or losses of pollution, right? This is like 280,000 yuan, right? Or around $34,000, But more recent, studies, suggested that Chinese residents are willing to pay an average of 3.8% of their annual household income to reduce PM2.5 concentration. By just a 1, micrograms per cubic meter, right? So you have seen what this is actually people, right? They have, they're willing to pay more in order to reduce the pollution, And that expectations, right, that this increasing need for better, high quality air by itself, right, is now, pushing for government, to make changes by the environment, to improve the air quality. Because
just coming back, we had a little bit of a technical glitch that hopefully we'll be able to iron out in the editing. But the next question I wanted to ask was in terms of the China's environment. You've mentioned so all these problems they've faced. But, some of it seems like a little bit like, the old story. So maybe they didn't prioritize, environmental health as much because they were both citizens and the government were really oriented towards, sort of a non-green GDP, just good old-fashioned economic growth, having a bigger house, a better stuff than they did, and you know, felt pretty successful when they looked at their lives compared to the lives of their parents. But now that's changing. People are really less concerned with their basic material well-being and are much more concerned with, especially in the urban middle class, are much more concerned with environmental and other kind of soft aspects of development. And also the government is more concerned with that as a long-range consideration. So now there's more priority on it. And also, the general assessment of Xi Jinping is that he has a lot more power than any individual leader for quite some time. So when he really cares about an environmental issue and he decides to take action on it, what kinds of challenges does he still face that keep him from fixing a problem if he decides he wants to?
Yeah, that's the thing. That is a great question. I think certainly right that when you have what I call, or many other political scientists called a bandwagon polity, right? There, you have a superordinate actor, right, in charge, then the other political actors, look to, him as, the bellwether, that ego to jump onto his bandwagon to show their loyalty and support, right? That actually facilitates, policy implementation, especially, right, if the the leader, right, that shows clearly, right, this is my priority, right? This the you're gonna find that this policy discrepancy, right, between the leader and the lead and the led is going to be significantly reduced. But that being said, that China, continue to face challenges in terms of enforcing this pollution control, because right, one of the challenges is that issue of legitimacy, right? You have to continue to justify its ability to rule, by delivering right this concrete, social economic goals, right? The fulfillment of those goals, that is not just about social progress in terms of the pollution control, but also when we talk about this economic progress. And unfortunately, right, even with all those calls on green GDP, right, that this pursuit of the GDP growth, continued to be a very strong incentive, right, that leads to the local government officials, to pursue robust economic growth, sometimes to the detriment of the environmental quality. Right? That is particularly a concern, right, in the post-COVID era in China, because they have this strong push, right, to recoup the losses associated with the pandemic. So you are seeing that they have issued more permits to coal-powered plants, right, in 2020, than in 2018 and 2019. Steel production has reached a historically high level, more than 1 billion tons now, right, even though the government is concerned about those so-called excessive the steel production capacity and trying to crack down, on those, the steel mills, some provinces, trying to, produce the steel, without, the government permission, this remains the concern in China, that they have found, for example, I think in March this year, the four steel mills failed to implement production curbs, you know, during even the heavy pollution days, you know, they were also found to have fossil.
So what happened to those guys? So I guess that's recall, you know, because what I think of, I mean, of course, in any, you know, country, especially one as big as China, I can imagine there's going to be people who want to, you know, work around the central, you know, orders. You know, it's not formally federalist, but sometimes it's been compared to a little bit of a federalist system where there's, you know, some independence down below. But these days, you know, given that if Xi Jinping or, you know, people acting on his behalf, if he really cared about the issue and he said, hey, shut down the steel mills or pause them when the air is, you know, extraordinarily unbreathable and they don't, were there any consequences for the people who snuck around and, you know, kept the mills open?
Well, they have this is a top-down approach, right? They have sent inspection teams, right? That's to the local level, you know, just to enforce the government, you know, the environmental control, the pollution control measures. You know, they were indeed, but the local government officials, you know, who neglect that duty of environmental protection would be disciplined, you know. Some were even even lost their jobs, you know. But the thing is that as long as, you know, systematic level, right, the risk of being caught, you know, and the cost, right, of being found, you know, to have not, you know, follow the government, you know, the environmental rules and norms, you know, remains lower, right? You know, than, you know, the
they're not being harsh enough with these guys. So they're saying, well, yeah, sure, I know that this rule is going to be broken, but maybe worst case, I'll be transferred to another job, or, you know, they'll punish me or fine my factory a little bit, but you know, the odds are relatively small. And you know, whereas I guess the certainty of, like, if I shut down the factory for a month, all these unemployed people are gonna riot in the street, or, you know, I'm not gonna make my GDP growth quota for this year or something like that, and that's gonna hurt me too. So they just go ahead and take the risk.
Yeah, absolutely, right. As long as the odds of being fined, you know, right, remains small, as long as the cost, right, of not honoring the government environmental rules, you know, remains low, you know, and, you know, if you could, being asked to, you know, like temporary shutdown, you know, then later you could reopen, right? You know, this is all, you know, like going to send a signal, right? The cost is really, you know, not as high, you know, as when you compare to the benefits, right? You know, excessive production, right. You know, that causes pollution.
Okay, so even the mighty Xi Jinping doesn't have all the power that he wants. And maybe he's got a little bit, it sounds like he and the other top leadership have a little bit of mixed feelings about, you know, how much they really want to tamp down economic growth, you know, kind of like in the U.S., right? We, you know, everyone says individually, like, I want clean air, but you also want a job. And when it comes down to, like, clean air, you know, for everyone versus a job for me, maybe I'm going to choose my job first. What about from the bottom up? Do citizens have any power to push for change in China? Has there been any developments or success stories in that front? I mean, you know, successful protests or NGOs that can push back when, you know, maybe if these local governments are not doing what the central government says that it wants?
Well, you know, if you look at the social participation, right, even though, right, when the China launched that war on pollution 2013, that it officially encouraged the social participation, right, in the process of pollution control, you know, but, you know, we know that after 2012, right, the civil society organizations, you know, has, you know, this in terms of the participation process, policy process, have overall, you know, being discouraged, right? As, you know, it's no, there are maybe still, right, the civil society organizations promoting for environmental protection, you know, like margins, you know, IEP, right? But overall, you know, they are, you know, the numbers are small, you know, they are, you know, their ability, you know, to participate effectively in the policy process remains, you know, like a negligible. You know, this is, again, it is a very top-down process, you know, that in fact, the COVID-19, right, this government response, you know, just to demonstrate, you know, that how, you know, that this top-down approach, you know, worked, right, in dealing with a major crisis, again, right, that would reduce the incentives for engaging, you know, the civil society organizations, right, in pollution control. You know, not to mention, you know, that in terms of, you know, tackling pollution, right, that the there is no strong, you know, like consensus, right, in China, even among the Chinese public, right, that this is something we got to, you know, do, right. This is, you know, this is something, you know, that you know, this the government needs to
right. Like, so there's a priority progress in the sense of making it more of an issue or taking it more seriously than they did in the past. But and then maybe the central government has a little bit more leverage than it did. But at the same time, it's also undercut a lot of the sort of developing civil society elements that kind of in the 2000s were starting to mobilize on behalf of environmental protection. And so now those kind of bottom up forces have been weakened relative to where they were before.
Yeah, I think this is the major difference, right, between what this the environmental, you know, protection movements, right, here, right, in the United States, and that if there is such a movement, right, in China, right, that is the U.S. is more like a bottom-up process. In China, it is more a top-down process. You know, this is how, you know, that in 2015, 2016, you would still have the hope, right, even at the government officials also mm-hmm. hope, right, you know, after the Chai Jin's documentary, you know, Under the Dome was released, right, the newly appointed environmental minister, you know, congratulated you know, her, right. There was, I think she was hoping, right, that was going to galvanize, you know, social forces, you know, pushing forward the environmental protection agenda, you know. But you know, once, you know, that, you know, this so-called I was trying to remember the name of that book.
It's okay. If you remember it.
So it was like you know very just within weeks, right, you found how, you know, this documentary was taken, removed from online, you know. So this is just you know, essentially, you know, shattered all the, you know, this hope, right, you know, this you can expect, you know, right, this effective, you know, social participation,
right. Right. Yeah, so for China's, people who don't know it, listening, just this was Chai Jing was a very process. Prominent journalist in the state-controlled media system, and she, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, Yanzhong, but she put together a documentary movie with various collaborators about the impacts of air pollution, and really, you know, it kind of spread through the country like wildfire, but then, which gave people a lot of hope that this issue would be addressed more seriously and would create pressure on the government. But then it was pretty much taken down and made off limits to discuss after not a very long period of time. And has there been anything, you know, from the sort of journalistic side, has anyone else done anything comparable? Like, is there still any investigative journalism, you know, uncovering when there are major health hazards that, you know, the political system or an ordinary kind of monitoring didn't uncover, or have they been pretty much stopped?
Well, yeah, we know that this kind of investigative journalism is very important, right? The contributor, right, to the U.S., right, the environmental, you know, environmentalist movement, right? It's you know, that you would, you know, that hope, you know, that same could happen in China. There was the actual time, in a way, you know, the we have seen, you know, those, you know, investigative reports, right, in China, you know, uncovering, you know, the health impacts of the environmental challenges, you know, but nowadays, environmental, you know, journalists themselves become endangered species, you know, that, you know, I don't even know there are, you know, really any, you know, who should be categorized as the, like, you know, real, you know, environmental, you know, but this, or journalists who are conducting, right?
Oh, that's sad to hear. Yeah, I hadn't, you know, heard of anyone for quite a while, but I was hoping that I'd maybe missed some more positive developments, but it sounds like I didn't. Well, so that's you paint a pretty worrisome picture. But again, you know, for anyone listening, you know, this book is a great way to not only learn about the environmental challenges in China and, you know, how that may affect China's development in the coming years, but also to understand you know, the political system, the institutions there, the constraints that keep, you know, even a leader as powerful as Xi Jinping from fully carrying out policies that he might want to carry out. And that's very relevant, you know, as we think about, like, what commitments they make about, you know, trade deals internationally, or, you know, when we work together on global climate change, you know, if they can't even implement something that they want, then, you know, what is that certainly suggests there are going to be real constraints on the ability of the Chinese government, no matter how fearsome it sometimes seems, in its ability to carry out agreements that it's made with other countries, even if it fully intends to, which of course is also sometimes also a question. So why don't we move on from the book and what are you working on now? Seems like there's obviously endless fodder for thinking about health in China. Are you still working in this area, or are you moving on to some new topics?
Well, I'm planning to start working on my next book, hopefully in the summer. You know, I could start writing on the China. Well, this is the book I have been, you know, thinking about working on for a while. I just didn't find the time to write it. There's the book called The Politics of Infections in China. You know, basically, I want to examine, you know, they are China's, you know, response to major disease outbreaks, you know, from SARS to COVID-19. And of course, by the, you know, it's just, you know, now, you know, that we're still in this pandemic, you know, the China's response, you know, has been phenomenal, right? And so there will be a large chunk of the book will be devoted to China's response to COVID-19, you know, that, so, you know, that I will focus on the politics of China's, you know, pandemic response, you know, and in terms of how, you know, the government respond to initial outbreaks, why they failed to, you know, nip the crisis in the bud, you know, and how, you know, then this policy, you know, this the reverse course, you know, that enabled the government, you know, to take decisive and effective actions, right, to, you know, basically model through the crisis, you know, and in the case of COVID-19, even emerge from the crisis triumphantly and forcefully. You know, so there's a lot to talk about, you know, and what I found interesting is that when you look at the pattern of the government response to the COVID-19, it's, you know, that policy pattern is no different from, not fundamentally different from, you know, its response, you know, to like population control problem or, you know, pollution control problems. And, you know, there's no fundamental change in the public policy process. You know that I, when you compare that to the Moore era, despite this efforts, being using high tech means, right? Efforts try to institutionalize, those mobilizational efforts.
So Yan Zhong, as one final question, I just wanted to hear from you if you had any other recommendations of good books to read or other things that people interested in your topic should look into.
Well, I think the book I plan to read this summer is the one just, I believe, published by Penguin, I think, titled The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID. So written by Lawrence Wright. Might have heard of Lawrence Wright, who's just published this long piece in New Yorker, which I believe is a condensed version of that book. You know, I found that this account, right, of the COVID, how it's unfolded, not just, in China, but, this is how it impacted the United States, and the entire world. You know, this is very fascinating and authoritative, so, I would, if you want me to recommend a book to read, I would, suggest this one.
Great. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Certainly, it's all on our minds, although I'm certainly looking forward to getting your next book once you have time to bring a academic scholarly perspective to and all your existing knowledge of China's health sector to bear and then tell us more about what there is to learn and what insights can be gained from understanding China's COVID response. I'm going to throw in a recommendation too. My recommendation, just for people who are interested in from the economics perspective, thinking about this as human capital. The other big aspect of what we call human capital is education. And another great book on that topic is that just came out recently is by Scott Rosell and Natalie Hell on Invisible China. And it looks particularly at the shortfalls in rural education in China, which is still the vast majority of the population. Despite the best great stories about, the top schools in Shanghai, once you get out in the countryside, the quality of what students get, even if they complete school, is very limited. So this book gets into a lot of issues there.
It sounds very interesting because it reminds me how, when we talk about this upward mobility, I remember the days when I was a kid, right, in rural China, right? Because I went to the school, that's in the countryside. Even with, you could say, well, the urban kids, they received better education, right? They just, we're not on the same foot. But, it's still, I think that the system seems to provide, equal opportunity, even for, kids like me, could get into, one of the best colleges in China, So, I don't know what's the situation today, to what extent this has changed, and make things worse or better, So I look forward to also reading that book as well.
Yeah, well, I won't spoil the whole thing. I think part of it is, a big issue is that, all the families have left the countryside, so the children are often just being raised by grandparents who don't have the energy or skills to educate them. And then also the educational needs are much higher. So, there's always been exceptions like you who, can come from humble beginnings and to obviously rise to really high levels of academic achievement. But I guess on average, the situation is still pretty dire. Anyway, but I'll leave that maybe for another podcast or for people to pursue on their own. Well, thank you so much for meeting with me and having this conversation. It's been really informative. And again, hope everyone will go out and get your book. And we'll all be eagerly waiting for your next one.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure speaking with you.